Okay, just give me a minute here. Okay, before we get to our lesson on, let's make sure this thing's on. Yep, it is. Before we get to our lesson on human origins and what's called the anthropic principle in equality, argument for the supernatural origin of human beings, I brought with me three research papers that talk about fossils, but it's a different kind of fossils. I mean, I've talked in the class here, we're going to find the fossils of Earth's first life and put to the test different origin of life research models, and we got to go to the moon, because the fossils of Earth's first life will not be found here on the Earth. The geology has destroyed them, but we can go to the moon and find them. And so if we go back to the moon, and instead of looking for pristine lunar material, we look for the Earth-transported soil, we can solve the debate over the origin of life. Are the fossils of Earth's first life complex and diverse, or are they extremely simple, very tiny, and just one species? Well, it was Roger Penrose who is famous for producing the first of the space-time theorems with Stephen Hawking back in 1970, who's produced a new model of the universe as an alternative to the biblical cosmic creation model. And it's called the conformal cyclic cosmology, which is kind of another way for the idea that ours is not the first universe, there's a universe before our universe. And he argues that if there is a universe before our universe, and there's some cyclical mechanism whereby that universe leads to our universe, then just before that new cycle starts, there's going to be very significant encounters between giant black holes. And those encounters are going to cause an echo effect that we'll be able to see on the current cosmic background radiation maps. So we look at the maps of the cosmic background radiation, and that's essentially the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. Or to put it another way, it is the first moment in the history of the universe where light begins to separate from darkness. Happens when the universe is about 380,000 years after the cosmic creation event. Well, it was Roger Penrose who claimed, in conjunction with another astronomer, to have actually found concentric circles on the maps of the cosmic background radiation. And what he did, or the two astronomers did, is they took the map of the cosmic background radiation and they looked at, 11,000 different places. They looked in the cosmic background radiation. And what they would do is they would take at random a location in the cosmic background radiation and see if they could see the faint signal of concentric circles around that point. However, I remember when I was reading that for the first time saying, this looks a little bit like the Bible code phenomenon. And coming around Christmas time, I'm sure we're going to hear that again. The idea that if you go through, say, the book of Genesis, and you look at every 19th letter, or every 8th letter, or every 9th letter, or every 11th letter, you'll find a hidden code in those letters. But you'll go on our website, and we have four articles that basically rebut the Bible code by saying, if you're willing to pick any number of steps, like every third step, every third letter, fourth letter, fifth letter, and keep on going, eventually you will find something that gives you a significant message. That will work on any document. In fact, in one of the articles you'll see posted on our website, an astronomer looked at the Gettysburg Address, and by using the same statistical method, got all these neat hidden messages that are embedded in there. And, of course, there is nothing prophetic that they were able to get, nothing new, just that they found these messages of things that we already knew. So that's just an artifact of the statistics. Well, likewise, when I saw this months ago, Penrose was finding these little concentric circles in the cosmic background radiation, it's like, well, if you're going to look at 11,000 different points along the geography of that map, well, one of them is bound to give you a set of concentric circles at a very low statistical level. Well, what happened is an astronomer at the University of Toronto decided to put this to a rigorous test. So what he did is he took the data from the cosmic background radiation, analyzed the statistical noise in there, and basically generated a bunch of kind of toy maps, what we call Monte Carlo analysis, which is basically you could take the raw data and kind of let it spill out and manifest different maps that you would get based on the statistical noise that's embedded in there. And he was able to demonstrate that the concentric circles that Gurzadian and Penrose had found is a completely statistical accident. There's nothing significant about it at all. And therefore, the inflationary hot Big Bang creation model stands intact. And in one sense, astronomers knew something was up, because if these concentric circles were real, it would stand as a refutation of the inflationary aspect of the universe. And we already have measurements from the cosmic background radiation based on the polarization results that tell us that inflation is real. So, there's really no basis for doubting the inflationary hot Big Bang model. So, but now we actually have a rigorous statistical analysis that shows us the circles aren't real. And we really are looking at one beginning of the universe, not multiple beginnings. The Bible had it right when it said that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. We're looking at one universe, not multiple cycles of universes that predate ours. It also challenges the idea that somehow in the singularities of black holes there's physics that might lead to the production of new universes. This is evidence that that's probably not the case. So we do not have any fossils of a previously existing universe. We are living in one universe, one beginning, created by an agent beyond space, time, matter, and energy. Well, this was published in the Astrophysical Journal, literally just a few days ago, the October 20th edition. And a November 1st edition, which really was just a little while ago that it arrived in our mailboxes, two other papers were published. And it's an attempt to find out why we're not discovering the fossils of the first galaxies in the history of the universe. And so what this team of astronomers did from the University of Maryland is they developed a very sophisticated simulation of the early history of the universe to see what the first galaxies of the universe would look like. And a bottom line result is they discovered that they're much smaller and much less luminous than what any astronomer had previously existed, and really explains why we're not finding these guys. They're coming in at such very low luminosities. Just to give you an idea, we're looking at luminosities that are between 1,000 and a million times brighter than that of the sun, which sounds like a pretty bright object, but we're talking about this being spread over something like, 1,500 to 3,000 light years across, which means that the light signal is going to be incredibly weak. In fact, they make the point that the hope that we would be able to find the brighter of these, because we do have telescopes that could find these galaxies if they were as bright as a million times the brightness of our star, the sun. But what they're able to do in their analysis is show that if these galaxies come into relatively close proximity, and what they mean by that is within 3 million light years of a galaxy as big as our Milky Way galaxy, then these fossil galaxies will experience tidal stripping, which means that our galaxy will begin to strip away stars and gas from these first galaxies that form in the history of the universe, which means they're not going to be as bright as a million times the brightness of our star, the sun. And so the paper concludes in saying, we're going to have to wait for the super telescopes to find the fossils of the very first galaxies that they existed in the history of the universe. And again, there's another difficulty they point out is that these fossil galaxies will tend to merge together. And once they merge together, they lose the properties that would help us to identify them as the first galaxies in the history of the universe. Now you say, why do we even want to find these galaxies? It would be a profound confirmation of the hot Big Bang inflationary universe model, the model that's predicted in many different passages of the Bible. And so this would be another significant test and a confirmation of what the Bible has always taught, namely that the universe begins with a beginning of matter, energy, space, and time, expands continuously from that beginning under constant laws of physics, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. And since the Bible taught that thousands of years before any astronomer dreamed that the universe had those characteristics, really the first time that astronomers even had an inkling that the universe might manifest those characteristics was the early part of the 20th century. So literally for thousands of years, the Bible stood alone in saying we live in a continuously expanding universe that can be traced back to an actual beginning of matter, energy, space, and time, where the laws of physics are constant, and one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, which, by the way, implies that the universe must get colder and colder at a highly predictable rate. And I was just speaking up in Vancouver to the Freethinker Society, the Atheist Society, and actually showed them the cooling curve of the universe with actual measurements over that cooling curve, and showing how the Bible had accurately predicted in numerical detail the cooling history of the universe, again, thousands of years before any scientists even dreamed that this would be the case. So it would be a big deal to be able to find these galaxies and to be able to find them at the right numbers in the right distribution. What I like about these two papers published in the November 1st edition of the Astrophysical Journal is that they predict what the properties of these galaxies should look like, their colors, their sizes, their brightnesses, and where we're going to find them. And they basically conclude that there should be about 200 to 250 of these fossil galaxies in the environs of our Milky Way galaxy. And the easiest place to detect them are going to be about 1 million to 3 million light years away from the center of our galaxy. But right now, we don't have the telescopes that are powerful enough to detect them. On the other hand, there are two instruments that will hopefully soon be available that will easily have the power to detect these things. One that you're probably all aware of is the James Webb Telescope, which is scheduled to be put into orbit. Right now they're saying 2017, but of course that depends on adequate generosity from the U.S. taxpayer, which always isn't a guarantee. In fact, this instrument was supposed to be launched years ago. It's been delayed because of cost problems. On the other hand, the Europeans might easily beat it to the punch, because the Europeans are building a massive instrument. Well, again, they don't have complete funding for it yet, but they got all the plans up. They got the location, the site. It's a very high mountain site in Chile, a place where it never rains, where there's never any clouds, a great place to do astronomical observations. And this thing is referred to as the Extremely Large Telescope. And when they say extremely large, they're not kidding. The mirror is going to be 100 feet in diameter. So it's like the size of a radio telescope, but it's going to be an optical telescope. And it will not be as expensive as a James Webb because it's on the ground. But still, the funding isn't complete yet, but there's going to be a lot of pressure on the astronomical community and on various governments to fund these things, mainly because we already have a long litany of discoveries that could easily be made if we had one or both of those instruments. And it'd be good if we had both, because you always like to be able to confirm a discovery on two different instruments with two different designs. And in that case, this would be a possibility. Hand over here. Yes.
Is there enough mass in these newly discovered galaxies to change the standard matter to exotic matter ratio?
Well, astronomers are convinced, and we already have measurements that show that this is going to be the case, that these very old and very small relic galaxies are dominated by exotic dark matter. And very little of their ordinary dark matter has yet to be converted into stars, which is why they have such a feeble light signal. But there's another reason why astronomers are eager to discover these things, because they have such a high ratio of exotic matter to ordinary matter in them. This would be a great place to look for the decay of exotic dark matter particles. you go on our website at reasons.org, I think I wrote a series of four articles for today's new reason to believe that very probably astronomers will discover axions and sterile neutrinos before the Large Hadron Collider does. And that's because if we can, you know, do sophisticated enough observations on these ultra-dwarf galaxies, these galaxies that are remnants of the earliest history of the universe, that's a good place to find the products of inflatons decaying into axions, for example. So, but you can read about it on our website. In fact, I point out that by looking at the oldest white dwarfs in our galaxy, astronomers think that they've already discovered the axions. So that would be, axions in many models are the dominant exotic dark matter particle. And keep in mind, the exotic stuff is 6 times more abundant than the ordinary stuff. Right here.
Could we use the SETI instruments, the radio telescope, to search for these?
Well, the SETI instrument that we see up there in the San Francisco Bay Area, I forget what it's called. It was named after the Paul Allen Array, because Paul Allen donated a chunk of money to build the thing. Very nice instrument, but it's not powerful enough to detect these galaxies.
Would those galaxies be putting out a different radio signal that would make them detectable?
Well, the problem with these fossil galaxies is that they put out virtually no radio signal at all. In order to get a significant radio signal, you'd have to have lots of big supernova remnants. Well, the problem is these relic galaxies haven't produced many stars. And if they did produce any big stars, we're talking stars that would have exploded probably 13 billion years ago. And when they explode that early in the history of the universe, there's no radio signal left at this late date. Because the problem with a supernova is that it expands. And as it expands, its radio signal gets weaker and weaker as it gets bigger and bigger or older and older. In that case, we're not expecting to find any radio signal at all from these things, which is why we're going to need large optical telescopes. So that's the motivation to get the James Webb up there and to have the Europeans build this extremely large telescope. Yes?
Maybe it's a naive question, but a mirror that's 100 feet across, how do you get clarity, the perfection of that mirror? That size.
You can computer control. If you're talking about a single mirror that's 100 feet across, made out of solid glass, the law of gravity will deform the figure of the mirror. In fact, that happens even with the Keck telescope. So if you look at the Keck telescope, for example, it's not a 400-inch mirror. What it is, it's a set of 6-foot diameter mirrors. And they have a little, servo mechanism underneath the mirror, and a computer controls it so that under varying gravitational conditions, they can correct the figure and make it perfect enough that they can get a nice sharp signal. Well, this extremely large telescope is going to be using the same technology, but it really will behave like a giant telescope because all the mirrors are going to be on the same platform. So, just to house the thing is going to be extremely expensive. That's typically the way it is for optical telescopes, is that the dome is about half the price of the total instrument. So, but you got to build a dome to protect it from the elements. Yeah. So
that's the other question.
Yeah.
What about leaves?
Leaves. Well, fortunately, where this place is going to be, nothing grows.
Okay.
It's literally a place where there's no rain and no clouds. It's where NASA goes to do their Mars surface simulations. Because it literally is nothing growing there. It's just bare rock. So you don't have to worry about dead leaves or viral products or bacteria messing things up. And it's high enough altitude, too, where there's not much moisture in the atmosphere at all. It really is there's two sites on planet Earth where you get pristine optical astronomical observations. One is in this very dry desert plateau of Chile, where you're 15 to 18,000 feet above sea level. And another place is in the middle of Antarctica, where you're about 14,000 feet up, where the temperature remains a steady minus 95 degrees all year round, day and night. So, and that's really another good place to go, because when temperature changes, it's not just gravity that deforms a figure of instrument. Temperature deforms a figure of instrument. So, for example, when we're doing astronomical observations, we don't like to do them at dawn and dusk, because at dawn and dusk, the temperature is changing. So what you want to do is wait till a time when the temperature begins to even out, then you do your observations. But this place in the Antarctica is great, because the temperature doesn't vary by more than plus or minus 1 degree all year round, day and night. It just doesn't change. It just remains a balmy minus 95 degrees all the time. And there's no wind. This is a place that has no wind, no temperature change, and it's high altitude. So it's really the best place to go, but it's not the easiest place to build something. So, yes.
Oh, I'm just wondering, does the temperature matter, and why?
Oh, temperature is huge.
Okay, what is it
about? Well, okay, you want the coldest temperature you can get. The colder, the better. Because the colder the temperature, the less water that can remain in the atmosphere. So, for example, when I was doing radio astronomy observations in Canada for my graduate studies, I purposely applied for time in late January and early February, because I knew that would be the coldest time of the year. And I was blessed with minus 50 degree temperatures. So, and once the temperature got below minus 45, I could see the quality observations. They improved by a factor of 4 times. I mean, it was amazing. You saw all this noise in the radio signal, and once the temperature got colder than minus 45 degrees, and it doesn't matter, Fahrenheit and centigrade is about the same, suddenly you could see radio sources you could not see before. So the Americans didn't like it being that cold, so I was always able to ace them out by applying for that very cold time.
How cold does it get in Chile?
Well, the higher the altitude, the colder it will be. But it's not anywhere near that cold. So we're talking temperatures that are around 0 degrees Fahrenheit at nighttime. So it's okay. Not as good as what you get in Antarctica, but and good's a matter of opinion. There's a hand over here.
Minus 95 degrees, I mean, how long can a human being be outside? I mean, with all the clothing you can get, how long
Actually, this site that they found on a high ridge in Antarctica, it's more survivable than the South Pole. The South Pole in the wintertime gets down to minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit, but with 100 mile an hour winds. And so you get a wind chill factor. This site that they found on a high ridge in central Antarctica, there is no wind. And so it's a little easier to tolerate conditions where there's no wind. On the other hand, minus 95 is not pleasant. And you have to be very well prepared to survive even a few minutes at those temperatures.
I just have another quick question, but just generally speaking, the vastness of the universe, you say that the Earth is at the right place, right time, proximity with the sun and everything. Is there any part of the universe that if it wasn't there would affect the Earth? Or is everything in the universe all related to the existence of the Earth?
Well, everything in the universe is related to the possible existence of life here on planet Earth. If you were to make the universe even a tiny bit smaller, there'd be no possibility for life.
Really?
Yeah, and that's fairly easy to understand, okay? Because the mass of the universe determines the efficiency of nuclear fusion in the early history of the universe. For example, when you look at the sun, it's burning. We're getting heat and light from the sun because there's a fusion furnace in its core, basically a gigantic hydrogen bomb that's fusing hydrogen into helium and gives off heat, because the helium that's produced isn't as massive as the 4 hydrogen atoms that are being fused. It's E equals mc squared. So about 0.07% of the mass of the hydrogen is given off as pure energy just by the conversion of the hydrogen into helium. It turns out that in the Big Bang creation model, the universe starts off infinitely or near infinitely compact, and therefore the temperature as near infinitely hot. But as the universe expands from the cosmic creation event, it cools down. You heard me talking about that. Constant laws of physics. One of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, which means as the universe gets bigger and bigger, it gets colder and colder. Which means that there will be a brief period of time in which the universe, as it's cooling from near infinitely high temperatures, will fall within the range where nuclear fusion can take place. Roughly when the universe is somewhere between the temperature of 150 billion degrees centigrade and 17 billion degrees centigrade. That's the zone where fusion can take place. And the mass of the universe determines how quickly the universe goes through that temperature window. And the mass of the universe is such that we go through that window in about 20 seconds. So during that 20-second sliver of time, which is between when the universe is 3 minutes old and 4 minutes old, 25% of the hydrogen in the universe is fused into helium. So before the 3 minutes, when you look at the ordinary matter of the universe, all of it is hydrogen. It's 100% hydrogen. By the time the universe is 4 minutes old, it's about 75% hydrogen and 25% helium. And it's that mixture of hydrogen and helium that determines what elements the universe will produce in newborn stars after that epoch. And here's the problem. If you drop the helium content below that 25%, then when stars form later in the history of the universe, they will only produce more helium. They will not produce carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, all the elements that are necessary for life. On the other hand, if the universe goes through that time window more slowly, then you get too much helium produced. And that extra helium means that once stars form, those stars will burn with such great nuclear efficiency that they'll make a ton of elements heavier than iron and will not make the carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus. And so if the universe is not exactly the right mass, you will not get the elements that you need to make life possible. So if it's too small, you get no carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. If it's too big, you get no carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. It's got to be just right. You say, how fine-tuned are we talking about? Well, the mass also determines, it's a factor in determining how rapidly the universe expands. And if the universe expands too rapidly, then gravity can't collect gas to make stars. And if you've got no stars, you're not going to have planets, and you're not going to have life. On the other hand, if the universe were to expand too slowly, if the mass were so great that it would slow down the cosmic expansion to a greater degree than what we observe, then gravity would collect the gas of the universe with such high efficiency, all you get are supergiant stars, which quickly become black holes and neutron stars. And in such a universe, likewise, life is impossible. Now, in the absence of dark energy, we now know that dark energy is the dominant physical factor that controls the expansion of the universe. But if there was no dark energy, if everything was being controlled just by the gravity term and how massive the universe is, you would have to fine-tune the total mass of the universe in the early history of the universe to such a degree that if you were to add one dime's worth of mass to the universe or subtract a dime's worth of mass from the universe, there'd be no possibility for life. So we're talking a universe of 50 billion trillion stars, where that makes up 1% of the total mass of the universe, and adding a dime to that pile, or subtracting a dime from the pile, and that's enough to disturb the balance and make life impossible. That's how delicate it is, for those two reasons. Now, in truth, it doesn't have to be that delicately balanced, because dark energy turns out to be a more significant factor. But you might ask, to what degree do we have to fine-tune the dark energy term for light to be possible? Well, we have to fine-tune it to a quadrillion, quadrillion, quadrillion times 100 times more than what you would have to fine-tune the mass of the universe. So we're not talking a dime plus and a dime minus anymore. We're talking something that would literally rank a quadrillion, 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 quadrillion times, even tinier than that. And this is why astronomers look at dark energy and say, therein lies the most spectacular evidence we have that we can measure scientifically for supernatural, superintelligent design. If you were to ask me as a scientist, what's the best evidence that you can provide scientifically for supernatural design? It's dark energy. And that's something that is widely recognized within the community of astronomers and physicists. That's not a disputed fact. And one reason I can say that, in fact, I think I even have it in my briefcase here, is I got a paper there that's titled Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant, another term for dark energy. It was written by three theoretical physicists, all of whom were atheists, and basically said that dark energy is real, and there must be this agent beyond space and time who's performing miracles for reasons of his own. But what they said in their paper is this is so utterly disturbing theologically that we conclude dark energy is not real. But the irony is that paper was published just months before astronomers developed nine independent observational demonstrations that not only is dark energy real, it's the dominant component of the universe. Literally makes up between 72 and 73% of all the stuff of the universe. So we really are stuck with this agent beyond space and time who's performing miracles for reasons of his own. Yes?
I'm wondering what those particular authors are doing now. But more to the point, these primordial galaxies, I'm wondering what those might consist of or what they might look like. We think of galaxies as being stars and dust and gas in some kind of structural form, but that doesn't sound like what these would be if they're still termed galaxies.
Well, the first galaxies that form in the history of the universe, based on our best understanding of the inflationary hot Big Bang creation model, would be very small. And the very small ones begin to merge together to make bigger ones. So it's what's called the hierarchical model. The universe starts off with nothing but tiny galaxies, but as the universe continues to grow old and expand, these tiny galaxies begin to merge together to make bigger galaxies. And in the case of our Milky Way galaxy, that merging was complete when our galaxy was about 2 billion years old. So we haven't really had any significant merging events since. And I'll get to your hand in a minute. But to answer your question, what do we expect these galaxies to look like? We expect them to be extremely faint, very low mass. We're talking like between 1,000 to a million times maybe 10 million at most times the mass of our star, the Sun, dominated predominantly by exotic dark matter, where most of the ordinary dark matter is still unused gas. In other words, the stars that have formed in these primordial galaxies, it just has used a tiny fraction of the available gas, which is why as our galaxy consumes these relic galaxies, it infuses a gas source that sustains the star formation and hence the spiral structure of our galaxy. So, hey, we're having Thanksgiving this week, right? You might want to thank God for the fact that we live in a galaxy that's consuming at just the right rate the right kinds of relic galaxies to sustain the spiral structure so that advanced life is possible and you can enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. You can imagine what Thanksgiving is like in our household, right? We thank God for all kinds of exotic things that most people never think about. Well, one of my sons liked the most is when we thank God for all the sulfate-reducing bacteria, which made possible the different metals that we could use to have cutlery on the table and enjoy our dinner.
So these galaxies would still have stars in them, but those stars would be made out of this different material than our stars, the exotic matter.
The stars are not made of exotic matter. They're made of ordinary matter. We would expect them to be very low metallicity because, after all, these are the first stars that form in the history of the universe. Although we don't expect them to be zero metallicity because, you know, the big stars would have a long time ago have exploded their remains. I mean, if we're talking the kind of giant stars that existed in the history when the universe was first forming stars, Those stars last less than a million years, so they're long gone. All you're going to see are the small stars, and the problem there is those small stars will be polluted by the metals that are exploded out of the supergiant stars when the galaxy first formed. Why? Because it actually takes longer for those small stars to form, just to become stars, than the entire history of the supergiant stars that would be polluting them. So our expectation is that the oldest stars in these relic galaxies will have a certain metallicity signature. It'll be low, but it'll be distinct compared to low metallicity stars we see elsewhere in our galaxy. Matter of fact, we think we've already discovered those stars. Because remember I was mentioning earlier we got a tidal problem? Our galaxy is so big that it strips stars away from these relic galaxies. And some of those stars are mixed in, especially into the outer halo of our galaxy. So astronomers have actually been making measurements in the outer halo and saying we're finding stars there that have a spectral signal or a metallicity that is distinct from all the other rest of the stars in our galaxy. They must be ones that have been stripped away from these dwarf galaxies. So when I told you earlier we haven't seen any of these galaxies yet, well, we've actually seen certain remnants from those galaxies that got stripped away because of the tidal forces of our galaxy. And we're finding them at levels that tell us that the numbers in these simulations must be right. We already knew that there had to be at least 100 of these relic galaxies orbiting about our Milky Way galaxy just based on the number statistics of these rogue stars that we're finding wandering around in our galaxy with a metallicity signature that tells us they have to be from the firstborn galaxies. So yeah, we know a little more than what I let on. But I think it's exciting as we're seeing a consistent picture coming together here. And yes, more motivation to get these super telescopes up and running so we can actually find these things, develop a more detailed model, and come up with even greater confirmation of what the Bible teaches about cosmic creation. Yes. So, by the way, you were first. I'm going to go for you first.
How
yeah.
small are these tiny galaxies?
How small are they? Well, I think the paper here says we can expect them to be between about 400 and 1,000 parsecs across. A parsec is 3.26 light years, so we're talking about 1,200 to 3,000 light years across. So they're fairly big, given that they have such low masses. And that's why the light from these things will be very feeble indeed. All you're going to see are small stars there, because anything big would have long ago have either become a supernova or a cool white dwarf where you're not going to see it. And moreover, most of the gas still has not been used to form stars. On the other hand, we wouldn't have this nice symmetrical spiral structure of our Milky Way galaxy if it wasn't for oodles and oodles of these relic galaxies still hanging around. Yes?
Could you remind me again, what is dark matter made of?
Okay, two kinds of dark matter. You got the ordinary dark matter, which is basically stuff made of protons, electrons, and neutrons that is so dispersed that it emits no light. Therefore, we can't see it. So, for example, we believe that there's lots of gas and dust in the outer halo of our galaxy that is so dispersed that we can't see any light coming from it. On the other hand, we know it's there because it has a gravitational influence. In fact, one of the things we discovered about our Milky Way galaxy, I think I did a podcast on this just this past week, so you can catch it on your iPhone or any smartphone, where we talked about one of the unusual features of our Milky Way galaxy is that it has a lot of mass that's not yet been used to make stars. And so they now realize that our Milky Way galaxy is as massive as the Andromeda galaxy, even though we have many fewer stars and much less light. It's because our galaxy is underluminous. It has a lot more mass than we would expect given the light that we see coming from our Milky Way galaxy. And by the way, that's a good thing. Something else you can thank God for coming this Thursday is the fact that we live in a big, ultra-luminous galaxy. When I say big, we're looking at about a trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. So we are living in a big galaxy. But it has many fewer stars than the Andromeda galaxy. And because it's underluminous, we're not being blasted by radiation from nearby bright stars or nearby giant gaseous nebulae. So the underluminosity protects advanced life. If you're a bacterium, it's not such a big deal. You're wanting to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner as a human being, yeah, then it is a big deal. But it's also a big deal to astronomers. The fact that we live in a very underluminous galaxy means that we can see stuff through our telescopes. If we were living in a regular galaxy, the night sky would be bright enough that it would impinge on our ability to specially see these distant galaxies. Now, I'm reminded of Bible verses that say the heavens declare the glory of God, they declare His righteousness. We live at the one time in the history of the universe and the one location within our galaxy, and our galaxy is in the one location of the universe where we humans can literally read the entire storybook of the universe. If we were anywhere else in the universe, we would not be able to read that storybook. We'd only be able to read part of the book. And if we were any other time, I think I've explained this to you before, one reason why we know that we must be living in a universe that's 13.75 billion years old, if it was younger than that, light wouldn't have time to reach our telescopes from the cosmic creation event. And God wanted us to see the light from the cosmic creation event. He wanted us to be able to read the whole history book of the universe. You can only do that at one time in the history of the universe. If we were here any earlier, light would not have adequate time. So, for example, if God created us 5 billion years ago, we'd only be seeing two-thirds of the history of the universe. We would not have any information at all about the cosmic creation event. And if God put us here any later, then dark energy would be expanding the surface of the universe at greater than the velocity of light, which means, once again, that light would never make it to our telescope. We're living at the one time where we get to see the whole story. We're also living at the one place where we get to hear, see the whole story. And we're at that one place because we're living in this super underluminous galaxy. And we're also living at the darkest light conceivable location in our galaxy. Anywhere else you go in our galaxy? Oh, wow, somebody put this up here for me.
That's what you were talking about, right?
Well,
one of them.
So those are the relic galaxies. That's the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And, yeah, if we were to turn all the lights off and blow it up a little bit, you'd see little tiny specks. And those would be actually the first galaxies that formed in the history of the universe, the first big ones. Yes?
You spoke about, ordinary matter and extraordinary
matter? Oh, I forgot to talk about the exotic matter.
Okay,
all right.
I had a CD about a month ago, and I have more detailed titles than online. So if anybody's interested.
There you go.
Extension 324 at church.
Yeah, Extension 324. She's the gal that puts out all the CDs from this class. And yes, we did do a detailed thing on the exotic dark matter. But just to complete the story, you've got the ordinary matter made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons that's so dispersed that we can't see any light from it, but we can see the gravitational influence. Gravitational lensing reveals that stuff is there. And then exotic dark matter is made up of particles that do not interact well with light. Protons, neutrons, and electrons have the property that they strongly interact with photons, which means if you get any clump of that stuff, it's going to emit light. Exotic dark matter, doesn't matter how much you clump it, it's not going to emit any light that you can measure because it doesn't strongly interact with light. To give you an idea, if you were to take a proton and push it into the Earth, it doesn't get very far when it impinges the Earth. But if you were to take a neutrino or an axion and throw it at the Earth, in all likelihood it'll pass right through the entire planet without making a single interaction. So every day you've got neutrinos and axions puncturing your body, it doesn't do any damage because it doesn't really interact with anything, at least not very often. So, and that stuff is six times more abundant than the ordinary matter. And by the way, without exotic dark matter, you will not have stable spiral galaxies with symmetrical spiral arms. So this Thursday, you might want to thank God for all those exotic dark matter particles, because without that, you would not be able to exist here in our galaxy, yes.
Say, if we were here any earlier in the history of the universe, the light from the Big Bang wouldn't have had time to reach us. But we're here from the Big Bang, and doesn't that imply that we travel faster than
Here's the principle. We are living in a time in the history of the universe where the farthest reaches of the space surface of the universe are moving away from us at a hair under the velocity of light. And because it's expanded that far, that means that light can travel along the entirety of that space surface and reach our telescopes. In the future, then that space surface, because of dark energy, will be expanding faster. The principle is the bigger the space surface of the universe, then the more predominant dark energy is, and the faster that surface accelerates. So it won't be long before it's accelerating greater than the velocity of light. And when that happens, we can't see everything on the surface. On the other hand, you can't see everything on the surface unless the farthest reaches of the universe are moving at virtually the velocity of light. So the universe is too young. It's not yet expanding fast enough that you get to see the whole story. There's a couple of websites you can go to that actually show you the geometric argument for why this is the case. But the bottom line is we're living at a special time. In fact, I use that as an argument that indeed God must have a high value on human beings and a high purpose for human beings, because how else do you explain the fact we're at the unique time and unique place? It can't be a coincidence. God must have a reason for putting us at the one time and the one place in this vast universe, as old as it is, so we get to see the whole story. So, the heavens declare the glory of God and His righteousness, and God wants us to learn something from that. Yes?
Is normal dark matter elements that we would recognize?
Ordinary dark matter elements that we recognize? Yeah, we're talking stuff that we're all used to. Protons, neutrons, electrons.
Just normal stuff.
Normal stuff.
Not together enough to really be.
Yeah, unless it's condensed enough and massive enough, it's not going to emit light that we can see through our telescopes. On the other hand, we can see its gravitational influence. That's how we detected the exotic stuff. We can't claim to see any light from the exotic stuff, but we can definitely see its gravitational influence. It bends light. So that was the principle of general relativity. You've got mass, it will bend light. Yes.
You say we're at the right place at the right time. Just within how many years are we talking about? Within 100, 1,000, 10,000? I'm just curious.
Well, you're talking to an astronomer, so when I say we're really close to the right time, hey, plus or minus a billion years is really quite close. Well, but don't quote me on that. Because to get that window, see, what you're asking me is how narrow is a time window where we get to see the entire story? That depends on the geometry of the universe, which we're still trying to measure to some degree of precision. So it could be extremely narrow, or it could be as broad. Well, I don't think anybody is saying it's broader than a billion years. Chances are it's quite a bit narrower than that.
Yeah, and also you said at the beginning something about 20 seconds during, I think, the Big Bang. There was 20 seconds where things happened differently. What was that again? I just wanted to...
Well, okay. If instead of 20 seconds, we spent 19 seconds going through that fusion temperature window, or 21 seconds, then none of us would be here.
Are you talking about right around the Big Bang?
Yeah. Just between 3 and 4 minutes after, that's actually between 3 and 3.5 minutes after the cosmic creation event. So what happens between 3 and 4 minutes is really critical as to whether or not the universe will ever have the possibility of supporting life.
So did God have a stopwatch? That he had
to Well, it was a very accurate stopwatch. I mean, you know, when I told you 1 second, of course, the fine-tuning is much more dramatic than that. It's got to be extremely fine-tuned. Well, the trick is you need to make the universe of exactly the right mass, and it's got to have exactly the right dark energy in order to make sure that you've got a universe with a possibility for life. We're talking advanced life. The fine-tuning is even more critical.
Does that point more towards the fact that there is a God?
Of course. That's one of our most compelling scientific proofs, that the God of the Bible must have created the universe for the benefit of human beings. We look at the universe and say, if it was any bigger, any smaller, a dark energy, or any greater, or any smaller, we couldn't be here. And the fine-tuning really does rank as the most spectacular evidence in any of the sciences that we can measure. I'm not saying it will remain the most spectacular evidence. But in terms of what we can actually measure in terms of fine-tuning design, this ranks at the very top.
Now, speaking of Thanksgiving and being thankful, where's Al?
Well, he's probably cooking his turkeys, I guess. So, now, go ahead.
Who and how figured out that there's that second minute window?
We astronomers have known about that for about 40 years now. So it's been around for a while. And the reason why we've known about it for so long, the science is quite simple. Because, you know, we've understood the physics of solar burning since 1938. Hans Bethe was a physicist that figured out. By the way, it was determining the physics of the burning of the sun back in 1938 that paved the way for the development of the hydrogen bomb. So without Hans Bethe's amazing research on the physics of the sun, we would have never had a hydrogen bomb. And say, well, maybe that would have been a good thing. But now what physicists are working on is capturing the physics of the sun in an engine that we can use as a reactor to generate electricity. And that's usually the way it goes, by the way, in physics. We make the bomb first, then we make the thing that's really useful, the reactor, later. So, I mean, just like the fission bomb led to nuclear reactors, the hope is that the fusion bomb will lead to a fusion reactor that will give us virtually unlimited energy. So, Steve.
Thanks. Something that might be most gracious for the class, as you notice every time it gets to a three-dimensional surface, or four-dimensional, three-dimensional surface of two dimensions, however we want to put it, there are about four or five questions that follow that. You mentioned a couple websites. I've Googled and I've not been able to find them. If you could somehow come with a couple, I might help them out.
Well, the one I'm trying to remember, there's a famous Australian theoretical physicist who has probably the best website and kind of giving you a graphical presentation of what all that is. And I've been trying to remember his name now for two Sundays. So, and what I like about him is he really has a desire to communicate to lay people some of these complexities. So it's a three-syllable name. He's Australian. He's Caucasian. He's written a number of books. He's also interested in the origin of life. I'll see if I can figure it out. It's on the tip of my tongue. I might figure it out by the end of the class. So, by the way, yeah, I'm down to my 10 minutes, so no more comments. Let's go. Okay. What we were talking about last week is the fact that we live in a universe where the physics is set up in such a way that it's impossible to bring the equivalent of human beings upon the cosmic scene in anything less than 13.75 billion years. On the other hand, we humans cannot exist in a civilized state for anything longer than about 41,000 years, according to John Barrow and Frank Tipler, and according to our calculations, it reasons to believe it's more like 20,000 years. And this is what Brandon Carter called the anthropic principle inequality, that it takes a million times more time to form a place where human beings or the equivalent can possibly exist than where we could exist in any kind of civilized state. And again, a caveat, I'm not talking about the maximum time window for human existence, but rather the maximum time window in which we human beings can exist at a level of technology that we started to enjoy 11,000 years ago. That's the basic definition of civilization. We actually start to have villages that specialize in different enterprises and begin to trade with one another, called the Neolithic Revolution, which means, according to our calculations, we've got 9,000 years left before that's all over. Now, we've been talking about why it must take, and by the way, God could certainly have done it a lot more rapidly with different laws of physics, but he had many very good reasons for choosing the laws of physics that he did. In fact, if you stick with this class, we're going to tell you how those laws of physics are crucial to bring about a rapid conquest and removal of evil. Without gravity, without electromagnetism, without thermodynamics, we're looking at many more eons of time for God to eliminate evil and suffering without damaging our free will than the laws of physics that he in fact chose. And that's coming up. But given the fact that he had many good reasons, and I think there's at least 12 different reasons why God chose the laws of physics that he did, we really are looking at a significant time. And we mentioned how much time it takes to get uranium and thorium up to the abundance level where you could have a stable, strong magnetic field on a planet with enough plate tectonic activity that you can generate continents, creation day three. And we talked last week, too, about how the sun is quite unstable when it is young, quite unstable when it is old. We need a certain luminosity in order to have human life existing. We can't exist down here. Bacteria can. This is where you get all the sulfate-reducing bacteria that concentrate the metals so that you can have cutlery for Thanksgiving. But this is not appropriate for human beings. We need a more, we need a brighter sun. And there's three epochs where you get a sun bright enough for the advanced life. You get it here, you get it here, and you get it here. But notice that these two places, the luminosity of the sun is changing dramatically. We need a stable luminosity. You only get that when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. Now you might say, well, couldn't God choose a sun that gets there faster? Yes, he could, but those are stars that are much more unstable in terms of their flaring activity. And if you go with stars that are take more time, once again, you have that problem. I think we mentioned this last week as well, that stars are like human beings. They're unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. They're maximally stable when they're middle age. And so, again, bacteria can handle lots of X-ray and flaring activity from the sun, but that's not true of advanced life. And if we go off into the future, things are going to get bad again. We're living at the best time. And it's a principle of stars that they're maximally stable in terms of their flaring activity or lack of flaring activity when they've almost exactly halfway through their burning cycle. In the case of our star, the sun, that happens when it's 4.57 billion years old. And we mentioned that the sun has an optimal mass. I'm not sure we got to this, but this is new material now, is that we look at stars that are more massive than the sun and less massive than the sun. They're not as stable as the sun. That's why you want to have your planet going around a star that's exactly the mass of our star, the sun, which is the big problem with the SETI program. They're tuning their telescopes, looking at stars that are not the right mass. And, hey, if they don't have the right mass, there's no possibility for advanced life to be existing on a planet orbiting that star. The flaring minimum occurs when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. And I think I've mentioned before that based on neutrino measurements out of the sun, we now know that extreme solar stability in terms of its luminosity can last a maximum of 100,000 years. And if you're curious as to when we entered that period of optimal luminosity stability, it started 50,000 years ago. So just based on this, you can get a rough idea, namely that you don't get adequate uranium and thorium until the universe is about 9.2 billion years old, and the sun doesn't reach maximum stability until it's 4.57 billion years old. Add the two numbers, that's 13.75. So that explains why it's got to be that old, and then why we can only exist in a civilized state for a short period of time. We're in that optimal stability zone for no more than 100,000 years. However, that's not the only time window you've got to make. There's all kinds of other time windows that also must be matched in order for advanced life to be possible. One of them has to do with the growth of the continental land masses. And this is something that geophysicists, just starting almost 3 years ago, were able to calculate in some detail, namely that when the Bible tells us that Genesis 1:2, water covered the whole surface of the earth, we now know that that indeed is true, that the earth begins as a water world where there's no land masses at all. And then plate tectonics begins to produce volcanic eruptions, and some of those volcanoes will pop up as tiny islands. But it takes significant time for the plate tectonic activity to convert the basalts at the bottom of the ocean floors into silicates. Silicates are lighter than the basalts, so they float above the basalts. And after a significant period of time, you get enough silicate production where the continents begin to grow. This is all based on a percentage of the total surface area of the Earth. Now, one point I want you to notice. This is where you get the most aggressive growth of continental landmass. Right here in the universe, or pardon me, the Earth, is about 2 billion years old. What does the Bible say? Beginning of creation day 3 is where God places the growth of the continental landmasses. Okay, 6 creation days. Where would you expect, based on 6 creation days, to find the growth of the continental landmasses? The beginning of creation day 3 would pop in right about here. So starting a little less than 3 years ago, for the first time, geophysicists confirmed an important statement we see in the very first page of the Bible, that indeed the timing of the growth of the continental landmasses is the beginning of creation day 3. Reflect that on 6 days. This confirms that in a very beautiful way. Now, what we know is that if you want global high-tech civilization, you want to be in a planet where the continents cover 29% of the surface area of the Earth. If it's 28 or 30, it doesn't work. You want to be at 29. That's where you are right now. And there's a book that's been written by a couple of geophysicists making a point this growth is going to continue. So in the future, we're going to be looking at 30%, 31%, 32%. And so that's going to close the window on which we can anticipate the existence of human civilization over all the continental landmasses. It really does have to be right at that 29%. And it's not 100,000 years wide, but there is a relatively narrow time window in which you've got the adequate coverage of the continental landmasses. Something else I can say about the continents, and that would be the orientation of the continents. If you want advanced life, it's critical that the continents be organized north-south. It's also critical that they be well separated. Well, plate tectonic activity has been operating for billions of years, where the continents have been getting bigger and bigger, but they've also been moving around. We're at that one time in the history of the Earth where we got everything oriented just right, where the continents are oriented north-south with significant ocean material between them. Why is that crucial? Because only on such a continental landmass distribution are you going to get currents that will be distributing heat flow over the whole of the surface of the Earth, where you've got cold water at the top, cold water at the bottom, warm water in the continents, and where you get a circulation. Why is that circulation important? It oxygenates the oceans. If you don't have those powerful ocean currents operating, it will not appropriately oxygenate the oceans. And if you don't oxygenate the oceans, you're not going to have enough phytoplankton surviving there and zooplankton surviving there and fish to sustain life elsewhere. Because keep in mind, about 75% of the oxygen carbon dioxide cycle takes place in the ocean. And for that to work at the level of efficiency that it does, we need that oxygen to be circulated. In fact, one book I can recommend is written by an atheist, a paleontologist, and it's called Under a Green Sky, where he documents that we are living at that one time in the history of the Earth where we got maximum oxygen flow, and therefore we got the maximum fish stocks in the oceans, and we have the maximum generation of the carbon dioxide-oxygen cycle, all of which are crucial for the sustaining of global high-tech civilization. And he actually, in the book, sounds the alarm on global warming, saying if we do not take global warming seriously, one of the consequences of global warming is it will begin to shut down these massive ocean currents. And when that happens, the oxygen levels will begin to drop. And when that happens, it's going to diminish the fish stocks, and it's going to diminish the plankton stocks in the oceans. But he says, worst of all, if you let that continue, it begins to proliferate hydrogen sulfide-producing bacteria on the seafloors of the oceans of the world. And hydrogen sulfide is something that's poisonous to advanced life. And he's actually claiming that this may explain a number of the mass extinction events we see in the fossil record. But the bottom line is that this is also a narrow time window. You must be existing at a time when the continents are the right size, with the right orientation. You want them north-south so that they can create that temperature barrier, and you want big oceans between them. You don't want all the continents jammed together. We live at that time. Well, I'm out of time. Next week we'll talk about the window of time we get for atmospheric oxygen, and one that might be of interest to a lot of you. We live at a narrow time window in which we've got the most petroleum that we can harvest, the most natural gas, and the most coal. So, again, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for putting us at the optimal coal time, the optimal natural gas time, and the optimal petroleum time. So, anyway, let me bow in prayer. Father, we do want to thank you for this season that reminds us of how much we have to be thankful for. And, Lord, as we read the creation accounts in the Bible, they declare that everything that you've created here on earth has a purpose in serving the well-being of us human beings. So, Father, at this Thanksgiving time, I pray that you help us to express that kind of gratefulness for putting us on this incredible planet. Lord, for designing, literally for billions of years, all the life on the planet and all the physics and geology of the planet, so we can be here at this optimal time where we can enjoy the greatest standard of living, the greatest possibility for launching, sustaining civilization. But, Father, this Thanksgiving time, I pray, Father, that we'd be particularly grateful for the fact that your desire is to put an end to the universe and usher us into the new creation with radically different physics where evil and suffering will never exist again. And thank you, Lord, that you've given us a technology where we can literally fulfill the great commission that you commanded us to fulfill back in Matthew 28. We can literally fulfill that within just a few years, not hundreds of years or thousands of years or millions of years, but just a few years. So, Father, I pray that you would motivate us to take advantage of this time, of the wealth and the technology that you've given us, so we can take the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world and usher in the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Hugh, thanks a lot.
Now you're welcome.
Now you were on Frank Pastore's show again.
Oh, I was. Okay, I didn't know that.
But he used to be a young creationist. Has he been converted yet?
Oh, yeah.
He's on our side now?
Yeah.